Hello, this is Jay Nemro. You're listening to The Life Autistic, and this is episode number 614. I decided a little while ago that I was going to try to work on an essay, because essays are ways that worked in the past. Now, I'm not sure how things work in the modern times. Essays work in the past to help people to morph into speaking careers, which is what I'm trying to do. If you want me to speak at your group, the phone number to contact me, you can leave a message and I'll get back with you. Make sure you sound legitimate. that tends to help. The phone number is 1-575-461-2716. You can also contact me by email, but you'd probably be well advised to contact me also by phone so that I know that you're legitimate. Anybody can send an email. It takes a little more effort and guts to make a phone call. The email address is autism, AUTISM, at quix.us. I was working on this essay, and I found out some things about myself. Not that I haven't done essays before, I've done several essays. You can go to my website, and you can go to some parts of it, and there will be essays that I've written on several things. And some of them are really great, and some of them are kind of too newsy. Some people thought I was just too technical. That's the kind of person I am. I'm kind of a technical guy. But I found out something about myself. I'm never finished with something. I'm always reworking. I'm always refactoring things. That's what it's called in different kinds of parlance, is refactoring. When you take something that's old and you work it over again to make it something new. Or actually just to make changes, improvements, slough off some of the stuff that wasn't important, make something better. I think a lot of speakers do that. I have never tended to be a speaker that repeated myself. I don't hold on to my talks to do them again. Rarely do I do that. I don't think I've ever done that because I don't tend to hang on to things that much. I tend, whatever comes to mind, whatever people talk to me about, that forms the basis of what I will speak on. I was doing this essay and I was trying to make some interesting points, and I always find that essays are more interesting if you kind of draw people in and then give them a different perspective. That's always interesting. I find it interesting, so I tend to do it. And if other people find it interesting, well, good for them. You'll find that most of the things I'm talking about are things that interest me. That's the whole point. You know, hopefully there's an audience out there for it. And the audience, it's the audience's job to find me. It's also my job to find them, but that's part of what this podcast is for. To go out and say, hey, where's my audience? And of course, I have to build it almost one by one, you know, because I've got pretty esoteric ideas. Anyway, so, I'm working on this essay, and the title of it ended up being, I am in favor of global warming and climate change. See, and that's weird, because if you were to think of it, global warming, as if in the normal parlance people do it now, if you're for global warming and you're for climate change, which is a weird thing to be for anyway, this would cause a weird cause. People would go, what the heck are you talking about? Nobody's for global warming. We want to get rid of it. How long is this woman going to be behind me before she realizes she's going 35? And she thinks I'm nuts and she'll go around me. She's locked into my tail. I love it when people do this. You know how easy people can be manipulated, especially when they're not paying attention. This woman is not paying attention. Finally, she's going around. I got her down to 45. That's just fantastic. I love it. It's fun. It's fun just because it's almost a branch of psychology. how people follow each other's butts, how people are such herd mentality folks. And I don't want you to be that way. I want you to be something different. So that's why we take these terms like global warming and climate change and we twist them around and we make people think, because it makes people wake up. Oh my gosh, the thing about climate change and global warming, and there's some people that are turned off by that, but they won't be turned off by my article because it's totally different. And it does it in two ways. Let me give you the little setup to global warming and climate change. First, I talk about some experiences I had in the Bight of Benin. I won't speak to being a sailor, because I'm not. I worked on a boat. I worked on a seismic research vessel, the RV Condor Explorer. It's since changed hands a couple of times. I don't know what the hull is actually up to these days. Anyway, we went across the Atlantic Ocean. We went from Key West, Florida, across to Port Lomé in Togo. That is a full transversal of the Atlantic Ocean, just in case you think I'm trying to embellish this. And it's a pretty long one, too, you know. We didn't take the shortest route to get from one to the other. Anyway, so in Port Lomé, I spent some time there in the actual harbor. Right next to Port Lomé, the water is interesting. I found it fascinatingly interesting. I had never seen 100 trillion, I don't know if that was really how many it was, plastic bags floating synchronized in off the coast of, on an ocean shore. I'd never seen that. It doesn't look like that in California, which is where I was born and slightly raised. I was only there until I was about 8. But it was. But that wasn't the most interesting thing. I was amazed by the people who fished there. Fishing was a big occupation of people who lived right there by the shore, right at, it's actually on the seaside of Port Lomé. It was, they had beautifully colored, decorated boats with flags on them. And these were not fishing boats like you would think going out for a pleasure cruise. These were more along the lines of a slightly bigger than maybe a rowboat or a canoe. It's a little bit bigger version of that. Sometimes with a really rickety, old, beat-up outboard motor strapped to it with bungee cords or something. Really kind of was kind of like that. But they had sails, too. They had bed sheets, and they would have masts in the middle just in case something happened, because I guess their old outboard motors broke down quite often, or at least there was a good threat of that, because they always had some kind of a mast from which they would run lines and have little flags tied to them. Very colorful. And they would have a bed sheet. You know, there would be the main mast, and then you'd have, I will not vouch for the term, top mast, where you'd actually hang the sheet from, and they would try to catch the wind a little bit, and it would move them a little bit. It would hopefully get them enough to blow them into the bay. One would hope. I forget how the currents do. I seem to recall that it's almost the nature of these things that there is a pretty good wind that blows in from the sea in the evenings and it blows out in the mornings. I may have it exactly backwards. I'm trying to remember just from my experience of being on the beach. And I think this is pretty common for the world, unless you're actually fighting, you know, the prevailing winds. Lily's decently close to the equator, so it may be in the doldrums. You know, I don't know. I'm not an expert on this stuff. Anyway, they would go out and they'd go fishing. And this was not a fishing pole. These were nets. They would do net fishing. Most of the time, there would be four or five guys in the boat, and they'd be toiling away. They loved coming and doing it at night next to our boats because we had lights in the water that would attract fish. And so they would love to come and cast their nets by where our lights were in the water. And unfortunately, one of our fleet vessels, we usually traveled in with several fleet vessels because of just the way we did things. You know, there were usually tugs that would go with us. You know, we would usually have at least three or four vessels in a group. We would always be the lead vessel because we were the gunship, you know. Anyway, there's too much to explain. It would be a wonderful thing. We used to pound the bottom of the ocean with air guns, basically big, huge pop guns. Pow! And the ship behind us would record the noise from them, and that would give them an indication of, you know, what the substrata under the ocean floor looked like, and certain kind of configurations where you were more likely to find oil in. And it seemed to work because people would pay us lots of money to have that information. When we were in Togo, we were being paid by the president of Togo. He was willing to get into the oil business. He wanted to throw a few oil rigs off of the coast in his territorial waters so he could make some money in oil. Because they weren't a very oil-rich country, apparently. They were trying, you know. They had some natural resources they were selling. But they wanted to get into oil, which is always a good business, especially today with the prices so high in dollars. If you're wanting to work in dollars, oil's an excellent thing to be in. Unfortunately, the dollar isn't worth a whole lot at the moment. So it's really, you know, it's kind of a two-edged sword. These guys would go out and would fish, and they'd come home. They must have taken all the flags off of their boats once they got home, because all of a sudden you'd have this burst of color. People in just the most, you know, women dressed in just the most amazing, bright, colorful clothes. Bright yellow like they were canaries. Even more bright yellow than that. If there was neon yellow, they would wear it. All these neat colors they would have the head wraps on their heads, you know, bright neon green, you know, to go with their bright neon green dress. It seemed to be the primo thing to do. And that was where they went to congregate. They would go to the fish market. And the fish market was just, there was flags everywhere. There was always at least 2,000, 3,000, 4,000 people just milling around. And it wasn't a very big space. It wasn't that big of a place. But, you know, if you wanted fish, that's where you went. And that was the primary occupation of a lot of people there off Port Lobe, was fishing. Or at least a lot of guys did it. A lot of guys that I saw were doing it. I didn't really meet them because we always had armed guards to protect us from the natives. You know, seemed nice enough people. We would, when we got tired of being on the boat, which was often, because, you know, we spent half of our lives on that boat, whenever we got the chance to go somewhere and get off of the boat, we would take it, especially when there wasn't anything going on. We spent about a month trying to get the necessary permits, trying to get all the environmental whatever done, the governmental red tape in Togo, to be able to actually do the survey we had come to do of the ocean floor. So we had a lot of spare time. You know, all of our equipment was packed up. It was all set to go. There wasn't anything to do with it, you know, except wait for the boat when they said, now it's time to go out and get to work. But that, you know, it took almost a month before that happened. So we were bored. And we would watch the TV from the boat. We got a couple of stations from Ghana, which were pretty good. We watched one of the fine movies made by the Togolese Film Board. It was a... It was kind of a soap opera-y sort of movie. It was based on the song, I forget what the song is called. Killing Me Softly. You remember that song from the 70s? That was its main song. It was its theme song. It was the sound tinkling around in the background when all this stuff was going. It was played all around schools and stuff like that. Basically the story of a guy trying to get a leg up in the world. He and his wife were having troubles. He was, you know, and finally he becomes a success, and then he tries to patch things up with his wife. It ultimately works out, and they finally get back together again. It wasn't a tearjerker, but it was nice. It was nice, but, you know, it certainly wasn't up to it wasn't up to Hollywood standards. We watched Dallas a whole lot. Do you remember that old show? Well, not terribly old. It was from, what, the 70s, the late 70s, early 80s, maybe? Dallas, you remember that one? J.R., who shot J.R.? We watched it. It was a couple of seasons after J.R. got shot. But we were kind of watching it as it was going out. It was going on. The Ghana station was actually kind of an affiliate of Deutsche Welle, which people in America have absolutely no clue, unless you've been international. There are huge networks out there, especially in Africa. Everybody wants to profit off of Africa. So they beam a lot of their programming down there, especially their old stuff. And Deutsche Welle, we were constantly getting news from Germany, because that's what Deutsche Welle is. It is the state the state television and radio, the state broadcasting in Germany. So we always got to hear what was going on in Germany. Of course, the Germans would often talk about the weird things coming out of the United States, and we would hear about that way. Because otherwise, we never would, except through the really pathetic email system that we had. That was one of my responsibilities to keep working, which was tricky because it was hard to keep our internet connection going sometimes. Anyway, so just to kind of give you a feeling for how it was, let me tell you about where these people live, these fishermen and their families. Not just the fishermen, a whole lot of other people live there too. I don't know what you would call it. In my part of the United States, it would be called a colonias, a place where people go where they can't really afford to go anyplace else. It's set up, and it's not illegal to live there. Conditions are pretty substandard compared to what we're used to. Let me try to describe it in words to you. I did take pictures. I don't have them with me, though. And you know what? I never developed them. They are, you know, 10, 11, 12 years old now. And I'm not really sure if when I develop them if they'll be any good now. It'd be great if they were, because I did take pictures of these people and these places. All the roads, of course, were dirt. Now I'm used to that because I'm from the Southwest and there are a lot of dirt roads out here. There's not a lot of people, you know. To get to a ranch house, you end up going down a dirt road 5 or 10 miles. And it's okay with me. But this was a press of probably at least 10,000 people, probably more. Lots of kids. Oh, tons of little kids running around, having a good time, going from place to place, going from one house to another. And when I say house, you have to put aside your picture of a house in America. Most of these things were shaped like concrete blocks. They were the nice ones. You could tell the people who had been a little successful. Now, as far as I'm aware, these were privately owned plots because people were buying, were putting permanent structures in. The really nice ones were built on a concrete pad. They had three walls made out of concrete blocks. They didn't go up very high. I don't know if people actually stood up in them. Some of them you could stand up in, but some of them were shorter than that. Of course, these were not tall people. And, you know, the covering over your roof was usually tar paper or something along those lines. Not, you know, there's no resemblance to what we would have in the United States. Most of them did not have electricity in their house. A few people did. I don't know how they did. They must. I seem to recall hearing some generators, so I think some of them ran generators, ones that could afford to buy gasoline for their generators, or kerosene. Kerosene's big over there. Those were the nice places, and there were some. There were some nice places. There were no doors. Most of the houses had no front on them. They were just, they would be more like a lean-to, almost. You know, they had the three sides closed in, and then they would have the front open onto the dirt road that went between them. They didn't have much of yards, because they didn't have yards. There was no grass there particularly. It was all beaten down. It was mostly just a dump, like, you know. When I look at it in pictures now, you can look at aerial photographs of it, satellite photographs. They're not very good. But, you know, it looks like a blighted wasteland. Those are the nice houses. Let's talk about the houses that weren't so nice. I have seen movies about Polynesia, you know, about the old days in Polynesia, and some say the new days, and I guess that could be true, too. I have not physically been to Polynesia. I have been to West Africa. I've seen how things go there. Anyway, here at Port Lomé, they had what looked like woven palm leaves. Now, I'm not sure if they were really palm leaves or not. This was tropical. I don't recall how the trees looked, honestly. I really do need to take a look at those photographs so I can know what I'm talking to you about. But I do remember these woven things that looked like they were made out of woven strips of palm leaves. Very well done. Nice, skillfully done, may I say, many of them were. But still formed into that same basic shape. Three walls, two parallel, you know, two side walls that were parallel to each other, one back wall that was perpendicular to those two. The front was basically open, and then you had some kind of a roof. Some of the roofs were pretty rough. Some of them were just made out of cardboard. Hopefully they had found some way to put some kind of shellac or something. Some of them had just the blue plastic tarps over the top of the cardboard. You know, these were pretty rough circumstances. If you compare it to the poor that we have here in the United States, there's no comparison. The poor we have in the United States are so blissfully treated that, I'm sorry, I don't consider them downtrodden anymore. I really don't. And that's not to say that they don't have rough lives comparatively to the people around them. Just to say that they should thank their lucky stars that they were born in the United States and that they're poor here. Because if you're poor in Lomé, Togo, you've got bigger problems. These women, just going to the fish market wasn't the only time they dressed up. They were dressed up all the time. They made a point out of it. They must have spent half of their income was just to clothe their wives, these fishermen. Because they did. I guess that was a sign of what affluence there could be in this colonious, this shanty town, basically, was what it was. all these little things were placed pretty well together. I wouldn't say that, you know, I would say that you could probably fit 10 or 12 lots in these little towns onto, you know, onto one of our basic house lots here in the United States. These were little bitty things. There were no two-room places that I could see. Well, no, there was maybe one or two. I seem to recall there was one that was being built that actually had two rooms, one for sleeping and one that was a little more public, the one that was opened up in the front. What was amazing, and I'm not telling you this to say, oh, you need to pity the poor people in Togo, because that is not my point at all. Because I'll tell you what was the most striking thing to me of all. It wasn't the environmental damage. It wasn't plastic bags floating out in the harbor where people were going to go draw some water for cooking, and hopefully they weren't drinking out of it. I think there was a community spigot in a couple of places. There was water available there. I don't, you know, but they had to hike a ways with you know, plastic jugs, pretty good sized ones, probably 5 or 10 gallon plastic jugs, to go and get water. You could see them cooking on kerosene stoves, you know. Now, we don't see a lot of kerosene stoves in the United States. You can get them here. They're mostly made in India, because India makes most of these kinds of things. They make it for their own use and for the use of other people that are in the same realm as they are. You can get them here, but they're kind of difficult to get. You guys would be more familiar with kerosene heaters, which are also made there. Stoves are basically the same piece of equipment, just bent differently and shaped differently, so you can put a pot on top of it instead of trying to radiate heat. It tries to concentrate it onto your pot. You know, nice. You know, and it's not bad stuff. Of course, kerosene doesn't smell so good, especially when it's first burning. It doesn't smell well at all, and it doesn't smell good when you're storing it. But it's convenient, and it's relatively low cost fuel, because these people certainly didn't have wood. They're, you know, there was a jungle nearby, but you didn't really use the jungle for wood. It was mostly wild stuff, and I don't know. I don't know how good palm burns, how smoky and crappy it is. I don't know. I don't even know if that was a tree they had. But the most striking thing, have I gotten to the most striking thing yet? Have I painted the picture good enough for you so that you can see it? The men dress pretty plain. T-shirt, usually kind of gray and dingy, because, you know, these guys do not have washing machines. You know, things get washed in the ocean. You know, get beaten, washed in the ocean. You know, usually just wore shorts. This was a place that was 90 degrees the whole time I was there. There was a rainy season and a dry season, but the temperature did not fluctuate wildly. It was 90 degrees. I don't know if it cooled off particularly at night. It seemed nicer at night. I went out above deck often at night, and it was nice. But look at the stars. The stars were so amazing. The stars are so amazing at sea. I love the sea, because it's just so, I don't know, it's one of those things that sings to me. Anyway, the most striking thing of all, you guys have the picture, but here's the most striking thing of all. These people were smiling. Now, there's nothing more amazing, I'm sorry, now, I don't mean to be racist, there's nothing more amazing and appealing than a dark face. A black face. When they smile. Because when they smile, you see them and their teeth just glow white. Whoa! course, they might be yellow, too. But they glow! Ah! And it's just amazing. And they were smiling a lot. A lot more than I was used to. I was even uncomfortable with it. And I'm basically kind of a happy, happy-go-lucky, good-natured, happy guy. And it was a little disturbing to see them, especially given the circumstances they were in. They were happy. The kids played. The kids, you know, the kids played with old, torn-up tires, old, anything they could get their hands on turned into a game. And turned into something to be played with, into imaginative play. For those of you in child development, these guys were masters at imaginative play. Because they didn't have regular toys. They mostly had stuff that they had scavenged from what we would consider to be a dump. But that was their lives. That was their home. And they were smiling. They were happy. You could see the warmth between husbands and wives. Not all of them, of course. You know, there was plenty of bickering and women getting all over their men. That seemed to be a big thing there. Women there were really kind of bossy. And men just kind of took it and just went, you know, throw their hands up and go off and go fish some more because their wife was making them nuts. You know, but there was a warmth there that was a little disturbing, too. I would come back to the United States, and you would look around, and although nobody was living in something akin to a cardboard box that I could see, you know, Tucumcari has its poor, has its, I don't think we have any homeless particularly, because there's plenty of empty houses that you can bust into so you don't have to call yourself homeless. And that's, you know, I'm sure the owners of the houses don't appreciate it, but that's life. That's what happens when there's nobody living in the house. Somebody's going to come and take management of it, whether it's mice or rats or homeless people. Not that I'm equating homeless people with rodents. I don't. Certainly don't. Anyway, they were happy. Warmth. And when I say global warming, I think everybody should be for global warming. When I see people in the United States, it's hard sometimes to see the warmth. That was why it was so almost kind of disturbing to me. Of course, this was a country where men hugged each other, where men held each other's hands. That was, I hope, friendship. I don't think there was any sexual connotation. I do not think it was gay lifestyles, because I would see them break hands to go off. They might have been neighbors. One would go to one house and kiss their wife, and one would go to the other house and kiss their wife. It wasn't a problem to hold hands. You know, it was just friendship, I think. And it was a little disturbing because we don't do that. We're very standoffish. And therefore, we aren't terribly warm people. And when you're with warm people, it makes you a little nervous because they stand close. They stand a little closer than you're probably wanting them to. When I remember this one woman, she was loud. It hurt. And she was laughing all the time. She was telling you a story, and she would just be laughing at the wonderful circumstance. It was still coming. It was still coming. She hadn't told you the funny bit yet, but she was laughing because it was coming. The anticipation was too much for her. And she would stand too close to you for Americans. Americans don't realize how distance is important to them. And I know that of myself. I am even more that way. I need more space. There's only a few people that I really want that close to me, although I think I've tried to get better over the years because I've felt that warmth of close, contact. And while she was laughing, she would sway and and she would bump into you. And she would, and when she did, she would grab you. She would not say, pardon me, because there was no concept of pardon me. When you see the press of people in places like that, just a swarm of people. I've never seen a swarm of people like I saw in West Africa. Just undulating mass of humanity. It was amazing. We don't have that in the United States. You can't get that many of us together. You can see pictures of Woodstock, you know, and maybe of the March on Washington back in the 60s, and that's the closest you'll ever come, and that was pretty offhand. That was the most touchy-feely could matter. That's everyday reality, it seemed to me, when I was in Lomé. Wonderful. And when I say global warming, that's what I mean, that kind of warming. We want that kind of warming, and we want everybody in the world to feel that. The warmth of human contact from somebody who one hopes genuinely cares about you. When I would go by, and we always went by in a van, so you never had tons of contact with these people at all. In fact, you had very little. Because of the armed guards. Every once in a while, we would do training, and that's when you would have that contact. It might have been somewhat stinted, you know. They're always trying to get more out of you than you probably wanted to give them. There was always the dickering going on. I was never good at it, so I tended to stay quiet to myself while all these things were going on. Very gregarious people. Great. Great people. Just wonderful. And you could tell that they were basically happy. They didn't mind their conditions. And I was thinking, and when you would see them touch and show affection to each other in public, because that's how everything was. When you don't have a front door, when you have no real private space particularly, everything's public. The public displays of affection, you couldn't make it illegal. You'd have to lock everybody up. It wouldn't work. You know, these were people that just had a whole different way of going at things. That's global warming. It's just trying to get warmer about that. Let me talk a little bit about climate change. I'm nearly to my destination, so I'm going to have to cut this short. It's sad. It's sad. Because we let policymakers rule our lives in the developed world. Now, I can't speak. I've only been in Europe a little. And I think that the developed world has a lot in common. You know, I didn't feel out of place in England or in Holland when I was there, mostly in airport terminals, you know, seemed just like any other place in America, for instance, just for the way people were. There were some differences, but it wasn't as huge as when you were in the shantytown. That was definitely a whole different kind of people. Anyway, policymakers do more to kill off the global warming, and the global warming I'm talking about, the general warmth and compassion and looking after each other that seem to be happening there in Lomé. We have, by policy, by fiat, kind of gotten rid of that. We've also gotten rid of the kind of pride that poor people used to have in former days. They might not have had much, but they could say, number one, this is mine. You know, our poor people, by and large, don't own anything. You know, it's probably rented, or if it's not, it's certainly something that is that you spent a ton of money on that you're still paying a huge bill on. So it never feels like yours because your credit card debt never goes down. You know, those kinds of feelings. I'm sorry, I don't really have a chance. We're going to have to talk about climate change later. My kids are already coming to beat on the door to tell me it's time to stop. This is Jay Nemro. Hope you enjoyed that first part a little bit. This is the kind of stuff I do when I'm speaking. And if you call me or write me, email me, the phone number is 1-575-461-2716. I'll be glad to come and speak to you. You just have to pay the bills to get me there. And a little bit more. We can always dicker on the price, although I'm a lousy dicker. I'm most likely, if you're paying for my way and it's not taking, you know, if it's not taking the food out of my children's mouths, I'll probably do it here at this particular point in my life. And I am, and you can also reach me at autism@quix.us. I'm sorry for being so distracted. My kids are going by. I've got neighbors that are, ooh, man, his chain's really low. That's kind of scary. Anyway, he's a friend of mine. autism@quix.us. Or 1-575-461-2716. And I'd be glad to tell you more about this. But you can always listen to the podcast, I suppose. But wouldn't it be great to actually see me make the gestures? I could probably bring pictures, too, so that you could see. That you could see what happens in other places. And what we lose sometimes. What affluence, what development might end up just doing to us that might not be very good. That's why I say maybe we should be for global warming, at least this kind of global warming, as opposed to getting all weird about the other kind of global warming. Let's get weird about this one, because this will change people. This will change the world and make the world a better place, I think. Certainly made things better for the people living in Lomé Togo. This is Jay Nemro. You're listening to The Life Autistic. This has been episode 614. Where's my pointer? Have a great day.